James, you're still on the call here?
Sure, yes, good
Ah,
morning.
what a delight to have you on the call and to hear your voice. James is somebody who's near and dear to me in many ways. I think most of you have probably read all the stuff online that was linked across the board. But James is, he's probably one of those people who's had a remarkable life trajectory that cannot be replicated, or he should have a warning label, do not try at home, For many years he lived and worked in Turkey and Lebanon, and the civil conflict there, the war and the massacre just influenced him very deeply. He then ended up spending 10 years as the director of Amnesty International's DC office. He met many presidents and foreign heads of state there and trying to affect policy change also. And then after that, he shifted his focus in a way to kind of hang out with some hippies, I suppose, but really trying to develop international development as a means of uplifting society. And in his last sort of final stage of organizational leadership was around heading up IONS, Institute of Noetic Sciences, that really works at the intersection of science and spirituality. But that was still a couple of years ago. So as he likes to say now, I think he's free of all institutional baggage, and he's just authored a book called Creative Stress, and he's launched this amazing Peace Ambassadors program, which we hope to learn about as well. But James, I just want to say welcome. So happy you're on the call. To start off with, I mean, you've clearly had quite an amazing ride. Before we get into your most recent work, I'm wondering if you could share a little bit about your personal journey. I remember when three of us, this is like way back in the days, many moons ago, we came to visit you in that small cabin in the Berkeley Hills somewhere, and you had kindly shared some of the most remarkable stories from your early life. And I remember leaving that conversation, and all of us were kind of in this mental state of mind where, like, words just couldn't even describe what we were feeling. We were kind of awestruck, we were kind of inspired, we were kind of elevated, but it was just very profound. And partly, perhaps it's just the way you tell stories, but it's just who you are, and it's just what you've been through. So can you tell us a little bit about, your formative experiences in your early life, and all the way. I know that you remember being in your mother's womb even, so you could start wherever you want, but
Right.
it'd be great to have some context.
Well, first of all, what a joy to be with you, Nipun, and just in awe of all of the work that you and the people you work with and your colleagues and friends, just the amount of service that you're spreading around on the planet is truly inspiring to me and to all on the call, my colleagues in service. I wish you the best of health today and much success in offering yourselves to the world. And I think, first of all, the word service is a key word for me, and I think of service as not any form of obligation that I feel morally obliged to do that. I don't think my life would have happened the way it did if that had been the motivation, like you got to do it, attitude. So much as feeling the potential of the universe, feeling the energy in the universe, feeling that latent field that just wants to be released. And it wants to be released, and it wants to be expressed through you and your qualities. So there is no single paradigm of service. It is how do we become our truly ourselves and release ourselves into the field of action. And that's where I think it's so exciting. So, I think of as a teenager, my family moved from Ireland to England, and from a seaside town in Ireland to the city of London. And at some point, I really became oppressed by the some of the poverty and the social problems in London. And I organized at age 16 a whole bunch of young people to do a survey of the treatment of senior citizens in this whole southeast part of London. And then we did a public reporting. And I got an award for being the teenager of the year. But what was fun about that was it gave me a lot of media exposure. And I got a letter from the head of the welfare authority in London saying, "It seems as if you have some criticisms and complaints about our delivery of welfare services to senior citizens. I would kindly like you to come in and have this conversation with me." And now I'm shocked at the level of arrogance of this teenager, but I was a little passionate at the time. And I wrote back to him and I said, "You know what you have to do, and when you do it, we can meet." But that sense of passion to serve took me to Turkey. I was vice principal of a school there. I really began to witness there in the civil conflict. I was knifed, my house was machine gunned. And it was the first time in my life where I could have had a very legitimate reason to not go on, to say, "Okay, look, you know, I've been injured. It's an appalling situation. People are dying of this conflict." But the first birth of real commitment came to me. And I think probably we've all experienced that at some point. We get tested along the path. We say, "Okay, are you in this for the ride, or are you in this really to go as deeply as you can into the path of service and the expression of who you could be?" And that work took me then to Lebanon, and I often say to people, right after the war and the massacre of the Palestinians, where I was in West Beirut during that period, that I felt the lowest point in my own path of service. Like, humanity is sick, it's depraved, the problems are too great, there's too much violence. And we can also all get to that place, can't we, where we just feel so overwhelmed by the scale of the problem. And yet, it was really meeting a Palestinian man in the midst of the rubble who served me coffee, you know, in the midst of the rubble of disease and death and wounding, that I had an epiphany. I had that sense of the spiritual dimension of the human coming through. I call it the indomitable spirit of the human being that cannot be bombed away, that cannot be mutilated away. And it stands there to remind us that we are spiritual beings having a human experience. Uh-huh. And that led me to Amnesty International and SEVA. And really, it was after that that I wanted to go one notch deeper in that work with the Institute of Noetic Sciences and social healing dialogues, which I've facilitated in different parts of the world. What is the root cause of these violations? Where does the wound begin? And it was really then, in my own journey, I felt the next level of maturing in the path of service, that I moved out of the finger-pointing, look at the problem, look at who's doing it, prosecute the violators, the whole right and wrong scenario, the whole moral righteousness scenario, into who's wounded and how can they heal? How do they get so wounded that they would do the things that they did? And how can we create systems and approaches that are healing, and not only of individuals, but of societies? So that's a quick tour.
Oh, that's beautiful, and I want to touch upon a bunch of those themes. But before we do that, it seems that suffering and healing are sort of two of the major components of your life. And even before we talk about healing, I was wondering if you could share some insight into suffering. You know, I saw the recent tweet you had made about Ram Dass's article speaking about suffering as grace, as many spiritual people do. And that's a really beautiful view, but it's also an edge. You know, in the case of dire poverty and abuse and war that you have seen firsthand and you have witnessed and you have tried to reconcile, it seems that it can also be just an intellectual kind of response, you know, sort of the navel-gazing critique that people say of meditators. How have you been able to reconcile this? Because it seems like you're one of these unique people who has seen this incredible firsthand, firsthand atrocities all over the world, and yet you also do see suffering as grace. And so I think you're qualified in a unique way to comment on it. So I was wondering if you could just share some insight into how you view suffering.
Right. I think there are two dimensions. There is the, if you like, the external lens, which is very important. If you look at torture, you have to be opposed to torture. You can't say, well, torture is got this hidden spiritual dimension, and so we'll just let it go on. We have a profound responsibility to change torture and to end torture. And that work takes us deep into the field of wounding and healing. But there is another dimension from the inside out that I've seen so much of, which is that even massive levels of wounding that a human can experience, unbelievable levels of cruelty, you know, the torture and murder of their children, or, I mean, we could spend all day talking about that level of depravity, that in that severity of testing and wounding, it seems as if again and again the picture that is revealed to me that sustains me and that makes me hopeful is that people can move out of the wound. They can move through the wound. I sometimes say the heart is a phoenix. You know, the heart is, out of the ashes of terrible suffering, something can arise. And it is there that the most luminous force on the planet exists for me. When I meet the Shahak family in Israel, whose daughter was blown up in a terrorist bombing at age 15, and they read in her diary, "I dream of peace with the Palestinians." They had no idea, they were quite conservative, that she had those feelings. Mm-hmm. And they dedicated their lives to reaching out to Palestinians and others who had experienced this loss and bereavement. In Rwanda, people who forgave atrocities by their neighbors. In Northern Ireland and in so many parts of the world, in the work that I do, it is when you look for that healing and you ask for it from people that the so-called average person can transcend the wound. And it's one of the most vicious elements in the story, Nipun, that when we get wounded, when we get attached to our wound, when we define ourselves by the wound, we get stuck, we stop serving, we stop moving with the deepest intention of the planet, which is to show us that in fact we can transcend any of those deep wounds and sufferings. So it is, I think, a twofold story of we must all work to end the suffering, and that comes from, I think, moving beyond very simple linear fixations with the problem or staying in the protest, you know, aspect of the problem without standing inside the solution. And inside the solution, there's so much more light. There's so much more possibility to say, I can see and respect the other even though I disagree with them. I can heal from even the most depraved insults and woundings, and move the story forward.
In a way, that's beautiful, James. Thank you. In a way, your book, Creative Stress, is really all about this, you know, and you talk about stress of being wounded as an opportunity for sort of this evolutionary leap, so to speak. But you're now speaking about this idea of social healing, which seems to be approaching healing also from a certainly from an individual perspective inside out, but also from a collective lens. So how are you defining social healing, and what are some examples of it? Because I think it's relatively new in this sector.
Right. Well, that link between the individual healing and the collective healing is a rich one, and we've learned so much, you know, in the mind-body health movement since the 70s. And in creative stress, one of the things that the subtitle of the book is A Path for Evolving Souls Living Through Personal and Planetary Upheaval. I don't know if any of you are there, but I'm sort of there. And one of the connecting points between the personal and that social healing is, for me, our relationship to truth. Because it seems that we're learning through science that the body has a total alert system to truth. And we sometimes bury that, we deflect it, we push it away, we try to numb it down or drug it down, we try to push it back in other people's faces. We do anything but face that truth. And when we do, we start a circuitry of energy and, excuse me, we start a circuitry of energy and activity because the body is being listened to. And the body, I think, is an antenna of universal consciousness. So it's not a trivial thing when we tap into our own truth and we stand in it. So I say, in relationship to the individual, the obstacle becomes your teacher. That which obstructs you, if you look at your relationship to it truthfully, it's going to be your teacher. Everywhere you turn is the face of your teacher. And then if we try to translate that into the social field, we get, of course, into a lot of complexity around my truth versus your truth and ideological truth. But one of the great advances in social healing is that we've come to bear witness to the validity of the truth of my experience. And you don't interfere with that. You don't deny somebody the truth of their experience. And what happens, Nipun, when you really, even if you've had radically different experience, if you tune in with honor and respect and deep and compassionate listening to the truth of the other's experience, again, the circuitry of the two, not the circuitry of the one here, but the circuitry of the two is ignited. The relational field is ignited because it seems as if we have a primal need to be heard, to be listened to. And when we are, something awakens in us, something opens up, that empathic field of connectivity. So social healing is so much about bearing witness to the other's experience and allowing that to be true. You don't have to agree or disagree with it. It's not like a philosophical point. It's bearing witness to the core, to the essence, to the truth of that person's experience. And it's in there that when you're in that relational field that you find that the opening begins, the possibility for reconciliation begins, the possibility for movement beyond the fixed beliefs occurs. And I've seen in various cases where people have that opposing views and then they go into deep dialogue. And you know what? After the deep dialogue, they're so relationally bonded that the difference in their views and beliefs doesn't really matter anymore. So what's important is accessing that field of being and connectivity that is deeper than the superficial beliefs that we hold.
Well, yeah, that's it. And that's so true, even from my limited experience. You know, James, you've been to Wednesdays, and I'm reminded of a Wednesday guest speaker that we had just sometime in 2011. And it was this fellow who works, Jacques Verdun, works at, San Quentin, one of the toughest prisons, and he brought along one of his friends named Rusty. And Rusty had spent 30 years in San Quentin because he had committed a murder. And Rusty opens his talk with, "I'm sorry. I'm sorry for all the hurt and anger and negativity that I've rippled out into the world through my actions of ignorance." And he opened with that, and it was like one of the most heartfelt talks you could ever hear. And it was, the audience is completely stunned because, in a way, they didn't know that they were going to listen to somebody who's who had committed a murder, and yet they were at, now they're in this space. And I had thought that it was so easy to forgive forgive someone like him, especially someone like him who's coming from a very different space, and hold him. And I just kind of assumed that everyone would be in the same boat. And what was really surprising, actually, was that a bunch of people came up afterwards and said that they weren't able to forgive him, or they weren't even, one or two people even said that they didn't feel like he belonged in that space of meditation, and it was really surprising for me to hear all those responses. And so, I mean, my question, in a way, around that is, why do you think forgiveness is so hard, and how can we create a culture of greater forgiveness? Because it seems like that would really help us. We all do small things, in ignorance, and sometimes we do big things, but, it's how can we hold a heart of forgiveness through all of this, and how can we encourage, the younger folks, and really just build a culture around that?
Great question, and Jack's work is wonderful. I think that element of we want to change the world, so we go out there and we say, this has to be different in the world. We have to do this differently, and you over there, you have to behave differently. And at some point, we mature spiritually into a place that says, I have to change in relationship to the world. There's actually an alchemical teaching that says, if you want to change anything, you must change. How about that? That's very precise instructions for activism. If you want to change anything, you must change. And that's what's so radically significant about forgiveness work, because it says we must change, and when we do, we change, the whole thing changes in relationship to us. And I think your question about how do we create a deeper pathway is really important, because there's so much science now around emotional intelligence. We know that forgiveness and empathic abilities, when you actually do curricular development work around a kid's empathic abilities, their test results in every other field of their educational curriculum go up. And so now science is saying, wow, well, it seems as if the emotional field is a root intelligence to all other forms of intelligence. Well, that seems to be a bit of an inversion from, the heady, it's all up in your brain aspect. And yet we're not drawing that knowledge down into curricular change enough. And I think that that's in a very important path of service. But, what forgiveness does is it takes something that is frozen in the universe. I began with that, my sense of what service is about. It's about this incredibly ecstatic release of energy that is allowing you to be you and offering your connection to others. And then if you imagine, well, what are the things that freeze that? Unforgiveness freezes it. As Everett Worthington, who teaches about this, says, and others, what you really want to do is release the state of unforgiveness, because it has a hold over you. It's freezing up this vital energy of the universe that wants to be liberated, that wants to connect, that wants to restore love and harmony and connectivity. And it's the deepest irony that people who've been victimized become then the victim of being held in that energy rather than releasing it. So even though they've been injured, the universe says, well, I know you've been injured, but now you have an opportunity to actually open up the story and release others as well as yourself. And so I think that's at the root of that issue, is that forgiveness is the opener. And I would say one more thing about it, because I've been given awards by the Forgiveness Alliance, and I am asked about forgiveness a lot. I was recently asked by a woman whose uncle was a Catholic priest who was violently murdered, and yet, after some years now, she wanted to know how to approach the man who's in prison for the murder of her uncle. And I said, make it real. Make it real. Don't make forgiveness this obligation business. Okay, I have to forgive. But write to him and ask him, how does he feel? What does he feel at this point? Does he know how much you as a child suffered in relationship to your uncle? Open up the possibility for real movement of energy and healing to occur, and see what happens. There isn't a formula for healing. If it's to be really real, you have to go into it with all of your clear emotions, but with the desire to open and to heal.
That's great. Yeah, and a lot of it also comes down to how you frame certain events and stories that seem to happen to you. One of the, in looking at your journey, of which I know so many beautiful stories, and I feel so privileged to know them and to have heard them from you. But one of those stories was when you were teaching in Turkey, I think, and you were knifed several times. You lost a lot of blood. You're kind of like lying there on the streets, and you could have held. You were wounded at the time in quite physical ways, even. And then the way you remember the story is that someone came and put you in the car and rolled you out to a public hospital and saved your life, and you never ever knew who this person was. And that's kind of amazing, to look at that injury that those five kids inflicted on you, but also to hold it with this remarkable anonymous act of kindness that someone did to you, and you've kind of like tried to pay it forward, your whole life. And such things have happened to you all the time, but you always seem to carry both of those elements in integrity, and I think that's really powerful and beautiful. So I just want to acknowledge who you are and thank you for being that. Before we go to open mic, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your latest work. I understand that the Path of the Peacemaker course, you're now trying to build peacemakers, I believe, across the world. I mean, you've trained at 250 of these peacemakers from 20 countries, if I'm not mistaken, and you're leading.
We've actually trained in the path of the peace ambassador training. We've trained 400, and we're looking to start the peace ambassador third training in March, and train another 200 before these massive scaled up planetary peace activities happen for the Summer of Peace 2012.
That's awesome. And you're also doing the Heal and Lead in Ireland, and it seems like you're really trying to plant a lot of seeds and create these love warriors in all kinds of in all over the world, quite literally. So I was wondering if you could encapsulate, what is the latest with your work, and partly it's also so people can have an avenue to get integrated into it if they're so moved, you know.
Yes, I think in my own journey, moving from the human rights to looking at how do you serve in international development, how do you look at the root causes in consciousness, it's the path is pointed towards peace for me. And, my image of peace these days is that we're no longer shouting at the gates, we're no longer just, raising our protest placards and opposing something, but we've actually scaled the walls and we're inside the city and we're inside the educational system, we're inside movements like yours that are so much about peacemaking. And the image that comes and the word that's referred to a lot is building a culture of peace. One of your callers in the sharing this morning was talking about responsibility, global responsibility. And it's beautifully expressed. If the caller doesn't know, or I just invite you all to go to Earth Charter and print out the Earth Charter PDF. It's available online. And it talks about universal responsibility. That yes, we've claimed universal rights, and they're sometimes violated. But also, we must acknowledge that each one of us has responsibility for the whole. What a shift! And so that's the nature of the work at the moment, Nipun, is building those arteries of peace, connecting many elements that I have learned, through my lifetime. And so in the Peace Ambassador training, we say there are five pillars. There's the pillar of the inner peace, and we do work around meditation, about the science of meditation, about the cultivation of inner peace in your life. We do another pillar, which is around wounding and healing, moving out of the ideology of right versus wrong to wounding and healing. Then there's another pillar where we look at communication, nonviolent communication, and all the dialogic strategies for peace building. And then the fourth pillar is systems approaches, because now we know so much about the connection between inner ecology and outer ecology, about economy and ecology. We're beginning to see how systems are interdependent and interrelated. And then finally, the final pillar is take it into the world, organizing for peace work. And we bring together people like Arun Gandhi and David Corton and Louise Diamond and many, Bill Urey, to help, bring their expertise to this 16-week training. But it feels really strong, and it's also a global classroom. We have in each of the courses about 200 per course, but about 20 to 24 nations represented. We have two people from Qatar in the current course, from Pakistan and Nepal and Nigeria. And that's hugely exciting to me, too, to be in a global classroom where literally the technology now, people Skype in and they use the Maestro technology. You can Skype in from Nepal and participate in a global classroom about peacemaking. So for me, peace is the focus of my work at the present time. And in that, there is still a heavy emphasis. I'm sorry, my voice is a little cracking today. In that, there's a heavy emphasis on healing. And as you mentioned, I'm starting this work in Ireland called Heal and Lead, because in so many places, those who are leading in public office are emotionally immature. They're almost like uninitiated adolescents. they do provide a function for us because they show us how not to behave, how not to be mean-spirited, how not to be so critical and judgmental. But I truly believe that, yes, if we could have a generation of leaders who've been deeply healed and immersing themselves in societal healing, they're the ones to lead us.
Yeah, that's great. And we'll also send out the links to all of your to all the ways in which people can get involved with some of that. And I presume it's all the latest is also on your website, James.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Awesome. Well, thank you. This is we're just going to go into the Q&A mode. So if you guys have questions, you can get on the queue by hitting star 6 as usual. And it'd be great if we have a diverse range of questions here. So we do have somebody jumped on the queue early on, and so I'm just going to go to them, but also for the rest of you to just hit star 6 and keep your questions succinct so that we can have more of James. So here we go. Do we have area code 916?
Yeah, this is Mo. Hi. Should I ask my question?
Yes, you're on. Yes, please ask the question.
Yeah, you know it's for me on. Okay, thanks. My question is there's two questions. One question is related to spiritual maturity. We know about the history of the world and all the suffering for many thousand years that existed in the world. And my question is that, is there any indication that there is right now at this moment of the history of the world, there is some indication which there is something different that didn't exist before that can help to have a spiritual maturity, and if there is going to be a quantum, if this is the time that quantum jump can exist, and that indication or that situation or environment have not existed before. That's my question. I don't know if I asked it correctly or not.
No, you did, Mo. James, is this...
Yeah, I'd be happy to take a try at that question. Yes, I personally believe, so I'm going into the subjective realm here. I'm not talking about objective truth, but I think I've alerted you when we talked about the truth of experience that we need to respect subjective truth, that it is my subjective experience that the ocean of consciousness is rising and that the so-called average person is in fact growing and deepening in awareness and consciousness, and that's why we've begun to see these tidal movements in democracy around the planet. And I think there is a field effect that as these ideas and capacities grow, that the whole ocean of consciousness is lifted. And what do we mean then by that ocean of consciousness lifted? There is a Sufi expression, Mahmud Abdal simply says, your heart must face its tests until some sweets turn bitter in the end. Your heart will not answer yes. So in the journey of the individual in consciousness, there must be this testing of the heart, because what we experience is the bitter or the sweet, and the aversion to the bitter and the attraction to the sweet. Give me more sweet, and never ever bring me any of that bitter stuff. Until in the enlightenment process or the growing of the consciousness, we move into what is called, or towards what is called, the non-dual state, where the bitter and the sweet become one, where we're not choosing and separating, where we're not guided by those kinds of locked-in preferences. And that is, I think, the movement in consciousness of individuals reaching enlightenment when they enter into that non-dual state and really experience the oneness. And I think that is also our collective destiny. And I do believe that we're shifting towards that, maybe for some slowly, maybe painfully, but inexorably, inevitably, humanity, it seems to me, is evolving into a deeper consciousness that will ultimately take us all through an authentic process into that non-dual awareness.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Nipun. Thank you so much, James. You gifted us with so many aha moments and inspirations to cultivate, you know, throughout the life. A quick reflection and a follow-up question. They really loved all your analogies, and particularly those, you know, body as the antenna to the universal consciousness, and our global responsibilities, and heal and lead, and all those ideas. A vivid memory that was brought up I want to reflect on was this experience I had reading through the Infinite Vision, the inspiring work of Dr. V, penned by Pavi and Suchi, where I think Pancho and a lot of our other friends also expressed, like, throughout your speech, each of those sentences where the sentences from the book where I had to underline each of those, and a similar experience was expressed from another friend when she was somebody gifted her a book of Bhagavad Gita, and she had this habit of underlining the sentences, and she ended up underlining every sentence of that book. Now the question, James, is when you have a conversation with yourself, these days, what does that conversation look like? Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm, thank you. Well, you know, next week I'm doing an interview for a group that the interviews won't be released until the summer, but they're collecting a series of interviews from people like myself, and the theme is radical transparency. Like, okay, come off your pedestal. What are you really dealing with? And, you know, where does the rubber meet the road for you? And I guess there are two parts of the question for me. One is that, like, where do I get wounded and get attached to my wounded? Where do my judgments, even though I work on being judgmental, where do they get very subtle, where I'm making subtle judgments about others and making those distinctions and preferences that somehow put me on higher ground than them? And I always want to dedicate my life to that authentic refinement process, because there's nothing more exciting than to work on oneself, as the Sufis say, polish the mirror of the heart. Keep polishing that mirror. And when you see those resentments growing, or when you see those superior attitudes, then, you know, polish them away, just release them. And so I'm looking forward to that interview, and I'm looking forward to continuing to work on myself. Where I have a tremendous sense of excitement at the moment, it's almost uncontainable. I do intensives for 9 people, and I've just completed my 4th one here. There was a young man we scholarshiped from Nepal who at age 27 has built 15 schools in Nepal, 2 women from Ireland, and so on. But the whole principle of the intensive is we are going to experience at the optimal level what it means to co-mentor, to co-teach, to look at that injunction that I mentioned earlier. Everywhere I turn is the face of my teacher, and to experience the power of the we, not the collapsed identity of the we, not the reductionist, exclusivist identity of the we, but the power of the way consciousness is moving into the collective voice with, you know, and if you have reverence for it, and if you practice everywhere I turn is the face of my teacher in an intense cauldron, I think you get this breakthrough of, wow, this is really how we are going to evolve. We're going to evolve through this deep reverence and connectivity with the we, and that the old leadership models, the old hierarchical models, just have none of the scintillation of the emergent we.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Michelle from Santa Fe again. First of all, on behalf of humanity, I would like to express the deepest gratitude for the life and work that you have done during your life. I'm totally moved and just unbelievably grateful that you're in the world doing what you're doing. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I'd like to ask directly the question that I spoke to before and add another one that I'm also playing with. One is, what do you think is the most important thing that human beings need to learn to be responsible global citizens? And then in addition, I'd also like to ask you a deeper one that goes with that. And what do we need to learn as society to be able to support responsible global citizenship?
In relationship to the first question, that there is no lesser being on the face of the earth. There is nothing lesser in the entire field of creation. Not, you know, so often I've experienced in human rights situations, in Rwanda, for example, they use the rats, the cockroaches. They try to find something to demean, right? But there is nothing. The cockroach is an exquisite example of evolutionary process. And every human being, so there's no lesser being. And that means then you are called to the table. You are called to the table, and I sometimes use the word juicy. I mean, it's that sense of fruitful, that you are fruitful, you are ripe, you are called into being to be yourself. And yes, there are forces that have knocked you about and that have repressed you. But the core message, the core invitation to responsibility is a responsibility to face that knowledge that you are not lesser in any form than any other being. And that in fact, it's almost like an evolutionary puzzle, that it is your qualities, essentially your qualities, that are needed, that are to be called forth. That's why peacemakers can be artists, dancers, teachers, engineers. It's the expression of your qualities. And then the second answer to the second question is really then the social aggregation of that, the social participation of what I was calling the joy of the emergent we, that this is the time of we, when you, if you recognize, okay, there is no inferior being, there is no lesser being, and that I, everywhere I turn is the face of my teacher, then how do we practice that in the social body? Because what happens so often in the we is the we becomes either superior or exclusive, or we're better than you, or it gets these identity fixations. And what we're calling for that will really arouse, I think, universal responsibility is that sense that we together are extraordinarily powerful and peaceful and productive. So it's really the combination of those two. Once you eliminate the first in yourself, I am not inadequate, I am not lesser, I am not inferior in any way. It doesn't mean you go to hubris or over-exaggerated sense of your identity, but that my qualities are called by the universe itself. I have been called into being by the universe itself. How about that? Then when you recognize that in yourself, and you recognize that in your others, we have a new game plan for humanity and a new evolutionary story.
Thank you. Our switchboard is lighting up, so we have lots of people in the queue. We'll try to get to everybody before we close around 10:30. Here we go. Next question.
Hi, this is Nitika, and I'm calling from Southern California. Thank you, Nipun, Rahul, and everyone at Service Space for setting up and coordinating these calls. This is my second time on such a call, and it's really, really wonderful. Thank you, James, for participating, for your presence, and for sharing your wisdom and stories. I can relate to so much that you have shared. It's almost a similar parallel life journey or process in that, you know, cocky teenager to, you know, being in the restorative justice, civil society space, protesting, being in an organizational mold, and then understanding that that too has its own set of issues, and giving up organizational roles to just be and to participate anonymously, whatever the present moment gives an opportunity for. So I'm really, really enthused hearing you. I have two specific questions. One is, you mentioned attachment to the wounds. And I've seen that both in myself and also sometimes in the community work, field work that I've done, is that that tends to be the stumbling kind of block, and it's only when there is a safe space that has been created that the opportunity can arise for seeking the truth that you mentioned. So the question is, what are the effective methods to create that safe space for everybody? And the second question is more a request. Just over the last few days, I had been mulling over an idea, which happens to correlate to the we discussion that you brought in here. And as my life journey has unfolded, I've had, you know, friends check in with me every so often and say, hey, can you help me with this, or this is something that could need input. And I thought, instead of having these, you know, one-on-one sessions with a couple of friends, let me see what's out there. And I opened it up to people and said, you know, we all are in this journey, tapping into the universe and being kind of the framework in this human body to let the work be done. And, you know, how about let's create a sangha, and let's come together. And just in the last 2 days, had a tremendous response. So we have now a set of people who have expressed a desire to be aligned with the universe and to keep to work towards a very wholesome expression of who they are and can be. So a request is, we would love if you could mentor us. Maybe I know you're probably not having the time and have tremendous requests like this, but maybe even once a year would be awesome.
Or maybe you guys could also get integrated into the peace work programs that James has as well. James, there's a long queue. Could you address the question of safe spaces before we go on to the next question?
Right. Well, and in relation to the second part of the question, I say to people, I don't mentor anybody, but because the paradigm has really shifted for me, I am happy to co-mentor, which means you have responsibility for mentoring me too. And that's the only way it can be in a universe of deep reciprocity. And when you change that, then I'm always in the mode of learning from you, and you're always in the mode of learning from me. And yes, do be in touch with me, and I'll see if we can connect for some co-mentoring.
Thank you so much.
With regard to the safety space, you know, I've just completed a book, Cultivating Peace. It will be out in May. And there's a whole chapter, there's a whole section on communication, but there's a whole chapter on listening. And we know now from the science that, you know, if I am not listening to you, but I'm really listening to my judgments of you, I will have a different electromagnetic field. I will have a different biochemistry in my blood. And if I switch into my heart and I say, however difficult this is for me, I'm really going to listen deeply to this person's experience. And that creates what we call the limbic flow. And so it's, as we were talking about earlier, the body knows when, in fact, you've entered into this state of, if you're not producing, if you're producing too much adrenaline and cortisol, the other person is going to stay agitated in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
If you start to produce DHEA and all of those happy neuropeptides and those compassionate states, what happens is it opens up. It actually, they've done research on this, it quiets the amygdala, which is the alarm system in the midbrain of the other. So get that just by deep, compassionate, aware, and conscious, non-judgmental listening. I can start to create a safer space for the other where their amygdala is less aroused, where they feel safe enough to begin to tell their story, which is what their primal need is, to be heard. So I think that's one aspect of the answer to that question.
Thank you. And James, to follow up on the second one, if other people have similar kinds of questions, what would you recommend in terms of getting in touch with you?
Yes,
through...
well, you can get in touch with me directly through the website, which is jamesode.com.
Okay.
That's jamesodea.com.
Oh. Should be easy to find also if you Google it. Next question. We have a bunch of questions here still left. We'll see if we can try to get to as many as we can.
Hi, James. My name is Elias. I live in Oakland, California. And I was curious about some of your spiritual teachers, your spiritual background, given some of the things that you've shared, especially about your references to Sufism and your time in Turkey.
Yes, I've been strongly influenced by Sufi teachers. But, you know, underneath that, there is always what I would call the teacher of essence. And, you know, sometimes Sufism is referred to the science of essence. So once one dissolves the eyes that are fixated by the form into what is the essence here, then I would have to say that, you know, Hindu teachers, Christian teachers, that I have met who are in that place of the essence really have been my teachers. But it's certainly a path that is around the knowing of the heart as a fully fledged intelligence and the surrender to the higher will. And a friend of mine who wrote The Untethered Soul has just completed an autobiography called The Surrender Experiment. He is a teacher at an ashram in Florida and is a teacher of mine. And one of the things he reminds us, which is where I think there's deep practice for me around surrender, is that surrender is not just letting anything happen that would be sort of anarchic, but it is surrender to the will that is the dharmic will, that is the path of, you know, for us, the path of service, but it is surrendering into will, the will to create the highest good possible in any moment. And I think that's a deep practice. I was recently asked to write for a book about where they're asking people, how do you pray? And I said, this is how I pray. Sitting in a circle recently with people from around the world who had been tortured or had been in those situations of extreme human rights abuse and so on, a Rwandan woman was so overwhelmed trying to tell her story that she first started gasping, then she moved to her knees, then she lay down on the floor, and then an African-American woman in the group was so moved that she lay on the floor beside her, and then a third woman lay down on the floor beside her. And it was really what I was saying in the paragraph about how I pray. This is how I pray, to be totally present for someone in the expression of their suffering, and to wait, and to wait and wait once you've been in the presence of that suffering, for that thaw, for that movement, for that flow, for that healing to begin.
Thank you. James, can you stay for another 5-10 minutes?
I'm a little tight. So.
Okay. We have a couple questions in the queue, but we don't have to necessarily, we may not be able to get to it. How about we take one last
one?
One more question. Yeah, let's do that.
Hi, this is Audrey. Thank you so much for sharing all these experiences. The question that I had was, it seems like you have so many experiences that really influenced the way you see the world, and I was wondering if you could share maybe like a really pivotal moment or experience that really shifted the way you decided to live or see things.
How's that for a concluding question?
If there is one.
Oh, there are many. I mean, one was that Palestinian in the rubble of the camps. That was certainly a very pivotal moment for me. Another was meeting a woman in Northern Ireland when, you know, the questioner earlier asked about, you know, the field of consciousness for humanity and are we going to be able to take a quantum leap. And I was doing a social healing workshop in Londonderry, you know, where they have the bog side and the Catholics live on the upper side and it's quite divided. And in the midst of this break, I went up to one older woman. I said, you know, you seem so clear on this theme of social healing. How did you get there? And she explained how she'd been shot and taken to the hospital. And when she was coming to consciousness, they told her, look, there is a bullet lodged right next to your aorta. We can't go in and take it out without killing you. I mean, do more damage to try to remove this bullet than to let it stay there. And they made her comfortable to die, but she didn't die. And it was in her telling of her story, it was that something triggered in my psyche very profoundly. Like, she didn't die. This was a woman who was shot with a bullet lodged next to her heart, and the universe said, you know what? It may look from every medical point of view and from every other point of view, you are destined to die, but you're not going to die. And 6 weeks later, you know, the doctor came to her and said, look, you're going to have to get on with your life. And at first she said, what? You know, I've got a bullet next to my heart. And he said, well, just get on with it. And what does she do with her life? She could. That's the ultimate victim story, isn't it? That's like, what did you get? Well, I've got a bullet next to my heart. You try trumping that one. And instead, she's a healer. She's a reconciler. She literally has a bullet inside her heart. And yet she goes around doing peace work. And, you know, in closing, that's what I would say to us. I feel the reality of the bullet in the heart of planet Earth, my friends. I really do. I feel this is an extraordinarily painful moment for planet Earth. Crisis upon crisis in the environment, in hunger, in poverty, in violence. The bullet is in. But that's not the end of the story, because we have a will to create something that is so much greater than the path that we've taken to date. And so even when the bullet is in, it's not the end of the story. So with that, Nipun, I encourage people to go to my website, jamesod.com, and I love you, Nipun, and your work, and each one of you who do this powerful dedication to service. Mm-hmm. There's no higher path. There's no lower path.
No, thank you so much. We usually end with a minute of gratitude. So if we could just take a moment to just be thankful, James. You have been so kind by sharing your time and your stories and just who you are with us today. So thank you for that, and thank you all for calling in and creating this space. You know, I think in very many subtle ways we are all connected, although physically apart from each other. So let's just take a moment of gratitude, a minute or so in silence, and then we'll do a collective thank you to James, and we will be off. So just a minute. Thank you all. So just as a sort of 1 second way to say thank you to James, I'm going to unmute everybody, and maybe on the count of three, all of us could just say thank you, James, or we love you, James. How about that? We love you, James. I think that's good. So on the count of three, we love you, James. Let me unmute everyone. Let's see here. Okay, I got to turn this. All right. Okay, we're on. Okay, everyone. One, two, three.
We love you, James.
That's always on the border of order and chaos, so it's beautiful. Thank you, James. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.